are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for Thursday, October 24th's reading of the Christian Science Monitor Daily. My name is Sherry McCundan. Today I'll be reading premium stories from Wednesday, October 23rd, and following up with miscellaneous articles. In this issue, Argentina's Javier Milei wants radical disruption. Is an Israel-Hamas ceasefire possible? Pressures mount on Netanyahu. Harris and Trump think big on energy in very different directions. How community kitchens are piecing Sudan back together. Zoo school helps teens prep for careers and college. Caregivers needed for children, trees, land, and rivers. Today's intro by Amelia Newcomb, Managing Editor. A radical makeover. Have you heard of Javier Milei? He's the president of Argentina, about to wrap up his first and very consequential year in office. Howard LaFranchi visited Buenos Aires recently and took stock of Mr. Milei's no-holds-barred drive to radically reorganize the government and reimagine a boom-and-bust, hyperinflation-riddled economy. His often painful pursuit of wrenching change is thrilling some. Others reject his rough talk and divisive measures. It's a major revolution led by a brash economist and former lead singer in a Rolling Stones cover band. One observer notes that Mr. Milei believes he's going to save the West with his model. See what you think. Argentina's Javier Milei wants radical disruption. Libertarian President Javier Milei is undertaking a far-reaching overhaul of Argentina's economy. Will people accept the pain and give him time to do it? By Howard LaFranchi, staff writer, Alfred Sosa, staff photographer, Buenos Aires and Puyahu, Argentina. Javier Milei, Argentina's libertarian president, who came into office last December, promising to take a chainsaw to the state, is giving his audience of elites the show they came to see. He's speaking to a gathering of the business organization Council of the Americas in a hotel ballroom with gold leaf chandeliers. The shaggy-haired economist, a former social media influencer and foul-mouthed TV commentator, known as El Loco or The Madman, is once again trumpeting the themes that brought him to the presidency. Argentina, in this century, has had the worst political administrations in the world. If this were not true, I would not have won, Mr. Milei says with a devilish grin. The audience, the upper crust of Argentine industry and commerce, laughs and applauds. The president reminds them that he thinks big when it comes to changing Argentina's long-standing policies. The only area in which he doesn't think big, however, is the size of the government. He calls himself a miniarchist, a libertarian term meaning someone who believes the state's only vital function is to provide the security that citizens need to exercise personal freedom. Since coming into office, Mr. Milei has eliminated 9 of 18 ministries. He's cut back the extensive subsidies on everything from electric bills and gasoline to health care, services that an estimated 60% of Argentines receive. His goal is to fundamentally deregulate an economy that international economists considered to be one of the most regulation-burdened in the world. Governing under the slogan, No hay plata, there is no money, Mr. Milei has delivered the first government surpluses in decades. He's also reduced his country's recent hyperinflation, arguably the single most important factor in his landslide victory last October, from over 200% annually to about 4% a month. Not only has he undertaken the biggest economic adjustment Argentina has ever known, he claims, but it is actually the biggest in the whole history of humanity. Indeed, Mr. Milei has made it clear since moving into the Casa Rosada, Argentina's deep pink version of the White House, that his ambition is vaunting. After he delivers Argentina from the clutches of socialist statism and woke progressivism, He wants his country to be an example, not just for a Latin America prone to leftward swings, but for the rest of the world as well. Milei believes he's something like a trigger for a new wave of right-wing leadership across the Americas, says Ariel González Lavaggi, director of the Center for International Studies at Pontifical Catholic University of Argentina. Actually, he envisions himself more than that. He believes he's the most important right-wing and pro-freedom leader of this moment who's going to save the West. Barely had the bachelor Mr. Milei settled his four beloved mastiffs into their new presidential home when he flew out to Davos, Switzerland, last January to goad the world's powerful with his anti-elites message. As president of Argentina, he has also attended the American Conservative Union's CPAC meetings in the United States and Brazil. He has lashed out against socialist Latin American and Western leaders, from Brazil's Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva to Britain's Labour Prime Minister, Keir Starmer. His oft-repeated pledge to make Argentina great again is widely seen as a sign of admiration for Donald Trump. Yet he presents himself first and foremost as a devotee of America's global leadership, in sharp contrast with the past decade of mostly leftist Argentine leadership that often seemed smitten with Beijing and Moscow. At his Council of the Americas appearance, President Milei pouts playfully that his global stardom is not adequately appreciated in his home country. It's interesting. The whole world sees the Argentine miracle, except for Argentines, he says, peering for effect over his dark-rimmed glasses. Despite his bravado and flair for rocking an audience, Mr. Milei, a former lead singer for a Rolling Stones cover band, seems to understand he's on an unforgiving political clock. He acknowledges that people can't wait forever for economic relief from the pain of his radical budget cuts. Indeed, as he pursues his relentless transformation of Argentina, Mr. Milei and others question how long its people, who have seen less money in their pockets since his policy adjustments, can hold on for an economic turnaround. Would-be reformist presidents of the past have long tried and failed to extricate Argentina from decades of economic boom and bust cycles. But perhaps most daunting for Mr. Milei is the prospect of transforming Argentina's ingrained leftist populism. Will the people accept such a radical transformation from a society in which the state provided a social safety net and employed thousands to one in which individuals, unshackled from the state, pull themselves up with their own bootstraps? For many Argentines on the left, Mr. Milei is seen as a blip in their country's history, a man with crazy ideas and reforms that will ultimately fail. They point to the example of Brazil, where right-wing president Jair Bolsonaro was voted out in 2022 after one term in favor of the progressive former president Mr. Lula. But others say this time could be different. With less than a year in office, Milei has surprised many doubters by accomplishing a list of significant changes, starting with reaching and sticking to a zero deficit, says Juan Luis Burr, chief economist at Fundación de Investigaciones Económicas Latinoamericanas, a nonpartisan think tank in Buenos Aires. What Milei has started is a process that could lead to the regime change he has in his sights, but it's a process that will require years of turbulence and hardship before it can succeed, Mr. Burr says, noting that this year the economy will likely shrink by 4%. The key will be how long people can hold on before they decide this regime change isn't for them after all. Martin Krauss, a libertarian economist who taught alongside Mr. Milei at the University of Buenos Aires, cites two reasons he believes this time Argentina's radical economic shift might last. For one thing, Milei didn't spring his intentions on Argentines after he won. He campaigned on them, carrying around that chainsaw wherever he met voters, says Dr. Krauss. That tells me he has a mandate. He also points out that polls show Mr. Milei retaining about the same level of support that gave him the presidency, even after months of economic hardship stemming from his zero deficit mantra. Argentines aren't libertarians, says Dr. Krauss, but they seem willing to continue with Milei's version of it if it means ending the assistance politics of the past decade and chopping down an overgrown state. Mr. Milei's ideas are starting to confront a vigorous pushback, however. With only 15% of seats in Congress held by his Libertad Avanza coalition, Mr. Milei saw his zero-deficit budget proposal roundly rejected when he presented it personally to Congress in September. His vision for Argentina would also be a stark cultural shift away from the state-supported populism that began about 80 years ago under the government of Juan and Eva Perón. But the Argentine people were desperate to banish the nightmare of hyperinflation. So even modest economic improvement could make Mr. Milei more than a one-term president, some say. The answer is simple, says Dr. Gonzalez. If Milei can deliver a stable economy and growth in a way that doesn't lead at the outset to too much decline in the living standards of the popular classes, he will win. His libertarian ideology and visions of a cultural revolution are a different matter, he says. But if he's successful in his economic management, we'll have Milei for a long time. Liam Toman is beaming as he offers a peek at a video on his phone. It's as if he were sharing a glimpse of a pearl of great price. In the clip, which was recorded by Mr. Toman's mother on a Buenos Aires street in 2018, a man, recognizable as Javier Milei, says hello to the young man. The future president of Argentina had just been told Mr. Toman is a great admirer of his. The social media personality and self-described anarcho-capitalist then shouts his signature slogan into the camera, "Long live freedom, damn it!" As it turns out, the slogan captured the mood of young men like Mr. Toman across the country. Young people, and particularly young men, not normally prone to political activism, remain an enthusiastic part of Mr. Milei's base of support. I think it's the rebel in Mr. Milei that attracted so many young male Argentines in the first place, says Mr. Toman, now a 20-something freelance sound engineer. And then it was his ideas about the need to free Argentina from the status quo of a suffocating state and a stagnant economy that made them his political base. Seated in a busy coffee shop in the capital's upscale Belgrano neighborhood, he underscores what intrigued him most about Mr. Milei when he first saw the outspoken economist on the panel of a TV show called Los Intratables, or The Misfits, in 2017. I was only 16, but he talked about things that made sense to me, like how the political class was only interested in having us pay for their privileges, or how the only way for ambitious young people to get ahead was to leave the country, he says. Hearing someone who said what I was thinking gave me hope. It also didn't hurt that Mr. Milei was a growing social media presence at the time, extending his iconoclastic ideas on a medium frequented by young men, but that largely remained unknown to their parents. The young people are always rebels, but up to this point, being a rebel generally meant being a leftist, said Dr. Kraus, who teaches at the University of the Center for Macroeconomic Studies. What's new now is that to be a rebel is to be a libertarian. Mr. Toman pinpoints Mr. Milei's war on la casta, or what he calls the self-serving political caste. He also emphasizes the president's unflagging determination to drastically downsize the state as a primary reason he and most of his friends support Mr. Milei. Argentine soccer fanatic, Mr. Toman dismisses the idea that young men are flocking to Mr. Milei because he rails against the social dangers he believes feminism poses, or that they are reacting to the prominent role young women played in legalizing abortion in Argentina in 2020. Don't forget that Milei calls his sister the boss, he says, referring to Karina Milei, for whom Mr. Milei abolished an anti-nepotism policy in order to make her his chief of staff. The current vice president and security minister are also both strong women, Mr. Toman says. While younger women may have been reluctant to support such a brash anti-feminist at first, they now see he's not a misogynist, and they're turning more supportive all the time. Some recent polls suggest that this is true, but many young Argentine women remain skeptical at best of what a Milei presidency means for the future. Before Mr. Milei's election, there was a real fear that all our gains won through the feminist movement were going to be lost. And now that he's president, we are seeing evidence of that regression, says Marcela de la Cruz, a senior studying international relations at the National University of San Martin in a working-class suburb of Buenos Aires. She cites Mr. Milei's abolition of the only recently created Ministry of Women as just one example of how the new president is setting women back. Milei is all about turning back to traditional ways, she says. Beyond issues of women's rights, Ms. de la Cruz says, the Milei presidency promises a hardening of society that will affect all Argentines, not just women. Solidarity is a feminine quality, but it's not something that is valued by this government, she says. Instead, Milei is all about individualism and governing with a firm hand. Those are more masculine qualities, she says. So maybe that's why so many young men were attracted to him. Young men are also attracted to Mr. Milei as much for his style as for his message, says Marcelo Duclos, a libertarian economics writer in Buenos Aires. And while Mr. Milei's social media presence was critical to his emergence as a political leader, Mr. Duclos said it was television and radio that first gave the president a platform to share his ideas. It was the traditional media that let the Milei genie out of the bottle, says Mr. Duclos, also an amateur bass guitarist. And then his ratings were so high that it became impossible to put him back in that bottle. The economics writer got to know Mr. Milei within Argentina's few scattered circles of libertarian thinkers about a decade ago. He still has the president's WhatsApp number in his phone. This past May, before Mr. Milei launched his new book at the venue Luna Park, Buenos Aires' version of Madison Square Garden, Mr. Duclos reached out to his fellow libertarian. My first thought was, no, a conventional book launch is too boring for either Milei or Luna Park, he recalls. So I WhatsApped Javier and I said, hey, how about we open this book event with a rock concert? The president responded, great idea, let's do it. Days later, the Argentine head of state let loose on Luna Park's stage, dressed in a black leather jacket, prancing back and forth like a mutton-chopped Mick Jagger. Mr. Milei whipped 10,000 cheering fans into a frenzy, belting out his own version of the song Panic Show by the Argentine hard rock group La Renga. It's become the president's signature song. I'm the king, I'm the lion, I eat the elite for breakfast, he roared to a rapturous audience, raising his arms and headbanging to a screaming guitar solo. After this rocking opening, Mr. Milei changed his clothes, donning a suit jacket, before presenting his new book, Capitalism, Socialism, and the Neoclassical Trap, to his audience, mostly men under age 30. Two cousins, Maximiliano Folco and Juan Ignacio Folco, are chattering about Mr. Milei as they give a seed-sowing tractor a tune-up. The planting season is approaching. They work for the Manapa Agricultural Services Company, not far from Pejajo, a city of about 40,000 inhabitants in the Argentine Pampas. I would say that Milei didn't win the election. The politicians of the last 20 years lost it, says Maximiliano Folco, as he inspects the seeding funnels that will soon sow soybeans, sorghum, and sunflowers in some of the richest soils on the planet. Once it came down to either more of the disaster we were living through or the change promised by this crazy Milei guy, people gambled and made their choice. Juan Ignacio Folco furrows his brow, indicating he sees things a little differently. I would say all of Milei's talk about freedom made a difference for a lot of people, says the taller and lankier cousin. The idea of freedom from the heavy taxes that were killing us was attractive generally, the tractor mechanic says. But for us farmers, Milei's talk of free trade made sense. I know. I prefer that we open up and work with the world in freedom. The cousin's words are tinged with a bitter and widespread sentiment. Argentina's political class has been wasteful and corrupt. Many believe it's impoverished their country and prevented it from advancing on a par with more prosperous neighbors like Uruguay and Chile. How is it possible that a country of such wealth can't even build a decent highway to get our products to the market, says Maximiliano Folco, referring to the dangerous truck-clogged national highway between Pehuajo and Buenos Aires and seaports. It remains a two-lane country road despite decades of promises to expand it. Agriculture exports, including the Pampas' renowned grass-fed beef, made Argentina a global breadbasket and one of the world's wealthiest countries a century ago. But recent Peronist governments, which typically had a more urban political base, imposed stiff export taxes on agricultural products, a failed effort to bring down domestic food prices and fill government coffers. Those policies made farmers furious. In protest, many regularly drove their tractors to the gates of Casa Rosada in Buenos Aires. Despite the ire of farmers and other rural Argentines, the majority of people of Pehuajo, a farming center about 230 miles east of the capital, still voted for Peronist candidates. Yet, Mr. Milei did a lot better than conservative candidates of the past. Many farmers and business owners in the area say they sense that support for the libertarian economist has gone up over his initial 9 months in office. They also say his rising support reflects the influence of young Argentines on their elders. My 20-year-old daughter was for Milei early on, and at first I told her, "How can you vote for him if you also support women's rights?" says Carlos Diaz, who has a 330-hectare family farm along with other parcels of farmland he rents to others. But it was the young people's enthusiasm for Milei's vision of radical change that got him through the primary round, he says. By the general election, I was on board and telling people I'd been for Milei all along. Other agricultural workers who support Mr. Milei say they realize his policies will take time. Once he got in office, he confronted certain realities, like he couldn't eliminate all the taxes he'd like to in one fell swoop, says Javier Pinto Kramer, who manages the Pehuajo branch of the Enrique Baya Casal Crop Seed and Fertilizer Company. "Farmers are optimists. We plant seeds and have great faith that the cycle will deliver abundant crops," he says. "And we have patience for that cycle to work. Right now, the country is in patience mode. But many people are hurting, so I'm not sure how long they can wait." On a recent Saturday at the National University of San Martin, kids are playing games on the lawn and parents are lining up for snacks at a carnival marking the National Day of Childhood. This commuter school in Buenos Aires serves mostly working-class families, but the revelries take place a day after the government released data showing 2/3 of Argentine children now live in poverty, and nearly 20% are, in fact, destitute. Those figures stun and embarrass many people here. Argentina has long prided itself on having a larger middle class and stronger safety net system than most of its Latin American neighbors, and most of them blame President Milei. These child poverty statistics reveal a very sad and shameful number, says Pablo Faturus, an architect from nearby San Andreas, who's enjoying the festival with his wife and two children. Overall, Argentina's poverty rate has soared to almost 53% in the first 6 months of Mr. Milei's presidency, according to the government statistics agency in a September report. This is the highest poverty rate in two decades, as 3.4 million Argentines have been pushed into poverty this year. While he agrees something had to be done to fix the economy, Mr. Faturos says having children pay the price of the president's economic experiment is not right. Many of the festival's attendees are public employees in education and health services. There's an underlying feeling that the libertarian president views them more as parasites than as public servants. "This government treats as if we're robbing the country and making it poor. But I can't go along with this idea that those who are educating Argentina's children and caring for the sick should pay for this difficult economic adjustment," says Juan Martín de la Cruz, an administrator at the university. Mr. Milei's idea is that we must suffer now for economic growth at some point in the future, Mr. de la Cruz says. "But where is that point? At first he told us the economy would perform like a V with a quick turnaround, and then it became a U with a longer downturn before recovery. But now I'm starting to believe it will be an L with no real recovery." The university here was created 35 years ago on a shuttered industrial site. It boasted such departments as nanotechnology and biotechnology, which were supposed to assist in the rebirth of San Martin. Today, however, the campus is dotted with abandoned construction sites, attesting to years of economic decline, large banners at the university's gates protest Mr. Millay's draconian cuts to higher education. Lucia Vincent, a political scientist at the National University of San Martin, says if Argentina voted to take a chance with Mr. Millay, it was more of a vote of punishment against the political class that allowed the economic decline of the last two decades than a sign of faith in Mr. Millay's libertarian economic vision. People were desperate for change, and Millay promised that, she says. So now, people are willing to give him the time he needs to get the economy working again. But how much time? He's brought inflation down, and people understand that, Dr. Vincent says. But on the other hand, there's no rise in economic activity and no real job creation. It's a ticking time bomb. Amid the screams of joys at the childhood carnival at the university, a minority of voices speak up for the Millay revolution, as painful as it's proving to be. The adjustment is hurting all of us. Our electricity bills and the cost of public transport to get to our jobs are way up, says Rocio Arevalo, a part-time housekeeper who's attending the festivities with her family. But it's true what Mr. Millay says, that a lot of people didn't work and lived off the state, Ms. Arevalo says. It's good to help people, she says, but it's also good that people know now they have to work. Damien, a father of two and owner of a small food services business in San Martin, confirms he voted for Mr. Millay, but he declines to give his name, suspecting he's among the few at the carnival who did. The truth is, it's a change that had to happen, Damien says, keeping an eye on his two children. The biggest change is Millay saying no hay plata and sticking to it, unlike the other governments that spent what we didn't have. Still, he says, the lack of money in pockets has made this the hardest year yet for his business, and that does test his faith in the Millay revolution. He worries that in a similar way, families are losing hope in the promised turnaround. I'm really not sure how long people will be able to hold on. Is an Israel-Hamas ceasefire possible? Pressures mount on Netanyahu. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu initially described Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar's death as the beginning of the end to the war in Gaza. Yet intense fighting continues. Are there any indications that pressures for a ceasefire will bear fruit? By Dina Kraft, Special Correspondent, Tel Aviv, Israel. At what has become a weekly ritual in Israeli streets in an unremitting war, rows of drummers pounded out a thunderous beat while protesters cried out in voices hoarse from repeatedly asking, "Why are they still in Gaza?" The chant refers to the 101 hostages still held captive there by Hamas. But this time, their guttural pleas followed the killing last week by Israeli forces of Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar. The mastermind of the October 7, 2023 assault, in which mass hostage-taking was a centerpiece, he was considered a central stumbling block in winning the hostages' release. Now that Sinwar officially cannot be blamed as the obstacle for bringing the hostages home, full responsibility is on Benjamin Netanyahu to decide what his legacy will be, to abandon hostages or to bring them back, says Ifat Calderon, whose cousin is a hostage, looking on at the protest Saturday night. Mr. Sinwar's death has left the already weakened Hamas's leaderless. Though as continued combat in northern Gaza shows, the Islamic militants are still a potent force. It has also added pressure on Prime Minister Netanyahu to seal the deal, which would mean a ceasefire in Gaza that could also potentially lead to a regional end to the fighting, something Washington is pushing for. But despite the domestic and international pressures, Israeli-initiated battles in both Gaza and Lebanon rage on. Maintaining a war atmosphere is what Netanyahu thinks is politically expedient, says analyst Alon Pincus, a former Israeli consul general to New York. As long as Israel is kept on a war footing, he explains, a commission of inquiry into the prime minister's own culpability for the October 7th security and intelligence failures is kept at bay, as are his corruption trial and moves to vote him out of office. He is thinking like a dictator, Mr. Pincus says. He sacrificed the hostages, and he's normalized daily sirens and attacks on Israel. On Tuesday morning, about 2 million people in central Israel, including Tel Aviv, awoke to the sound of air raid sirens after Hezbollah fired rockets deep into the country, all of which were intercepted. Just hours later, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken landed and began talks with Mr. Netanyahu and other Israeli officials. The State Department said the talks were centered on ending the fighting in Gaza, releasing the hostages, and dramatically increasing the flow of desperately needed humanitarian aid to Palestinian civilians in Gaza. There's also an understanding that Mr. Blinken, 2 weeks before U.S. elections, was lobbying hard for Israel to temper its planned retaliation for an Iranian missile barrage earlier this month. Secretary Blinken underscored the need to capitalize on Israel's successful action to bring Yahya Sinwar to justice by securing the release of all hostages and ending the conflict in Gaza in a way that provides lasting security for Israelis and Palestinians alike, said State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller. In a letter last week, Mr. Blinken and Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin issued a severe warning that Israel faced a halt in U.S. weapons deliveries if it did not take immediate steps to increase the flow of aid into Gaza. The government says it has done so, and there are indications it is exploring new options for the aid's distribution. According to Lazar Berman, diplomatic correspondent for the Times of Israel, the focus of Israel's campaign now may be shifting toward dismantling Hamas's civil governance, which would mean removing it from distributing any of the aid. But halting the fighting altogether in Gaza is more of a sticking point. Just after Mr. Sinwar was killed by soldiers in Rafah who came across him by chance, Mr. Netanyahu described his death as the beginning of the end to the war, should Hamas demilitarize and return the hostages. That language from a leader who has resisted any talk of a day after the war was seen as a possible opening. He did not go on to say there was room for more maneuverability, but perhaps there's a crack there of opportunity. Although, I don't know whether to say there's even as much as a window, says Shira Efron, Senior Director of Policy Research at the Israeli Policy Forum. She notes it also very much depends on what happens next within Hamas, whose leadership is in flux and which could even fracture into factions. Although domestic pressure for a hostage deal does not seem to be swaying Mr. Netanyahu, there is guarded optimism in the government about an opportunity for some progress toward a deal now that Mr. Sinwar is dead, says Mr. Berman. Since hostages are spread around with different factions within Hamas, and even outside of Hamas, he says, there's a possibility for some separate deals, some smaller deals. Israeli leaders have alluded to when they proposed to Hamas fighters, return the hostages, we'll make sure you get out alive. Ronan Barr, head of the Shin Bet Security Service, who was in Cairo Sunday, is working toward reaching an initial smaller deal of a few hostages in exchange for a brief ceasefire, Mr. Berman notes. Mossad Director David Barnea, he says, is talking about a broader deal to include all of the hostages, a day after plan in Gaza, an arrangement in Lebanon, and Israel actually winning the war with diplomacy. Mr. Netanyahu saw his popularity plummet after October 7th, has been buoyed by recent military successes in Lebanon, and a lack of any real opposition in parliament. He recently bought Gideon Sa'ar, a formal rival, into his coalition, bolstering its more moderate faction. Until now, far-right cabinet members have obstructed a ceasefire deal, especially as it would likely include the release of Palestinian security prisoners. And herein lies another reason Mr. Netanyahu is not rushing toward a truce, says Mitchell Barak, an analyst who worked with him in the 1990s. The problem is that Netanyahu would have to release terrorists, which he's not interested in doing. He traded Sinwar, he says, referring to a lopsided 2011 deal in which Mr. Sinwar and hundreds of others were freed to obtain the return of a captured Israeli soldier. But what no one in his government, the most extreme right in Israel's history, support is any talk of a two-state solution, which is very much part of the international community's vision of a day-after plan for Israel and the Palestinians. For many Israelis still traumatized by the October 7th massacre, the concept is an anathema as well. Netanyahu understands the war will not last forever, and at some point he will need to go for a compromise. The question is when, says Shuki Friedman, Director General of the Jewish People Policy Institute, a Jerusalem think tank. The timing, he says, will depend on Hamas being weakened enough to no longer pose a threat. Meanwhile, the Israeli army is in the midst of an offensive in the Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza. The aim, it says, is to quash a guerrilla-style insurgency rebuilding there, an indication of how lethal Hamas fighters can still be, even when operating without central leadership, is that they managed to kill a top Israeli commander there Monday. There are concerns in northern Gaza that Israel may be planning to remove civilians from that part of the enclave and push them south. It's a policy openly endorsed by far-right ministers who are championing the idea of reestablishing a Jewish settlement block in the area. Although Mr. Netanyahu has not publicly endorsed annexing part of Gaza, and it remains a fringe concept, members of his own Likud party and government ministers attended a conference this week called Preparing to Resettle Gaza. Harris and Trump think big on energy in very different directions. Kamala Harris and Donald Trump both paint a future with abundant energy. Her plans center on renewable sources. He backs traditional fuels, rejecting climate change as a priority. By Stephanie Haynes, staff writer. Former President Donald Trump has called climate change a hoax and has questioned whether scientists know that the world is heating. Vice President Kamala Harris has called it an existential threat and has been instrumental in directing federal money to clean energy initiatives. In many ways, the U.S. presidential candidates could not seem more different when it comes to climate change or the future of America's energy systems. Yet along with the dramatic differences, there may be some common ground between the two presidential candidates' positions on climate change and energy, says Brad Townsend, Vice President for Policy and Outreach at the Center for Climate and Energy Solutions. Both seem to be of the mind that energy is prosperity, he says. They just have different views about how to make that prosperity materialize. Both candidates, for instance, have said they want it to be easier for energy companies to get approval for new infrastructure. And both support what is generally known as permitting reform, efforts to streamline the regulatory process for new facilities. But a key difference between the two is which energy sources they most support. Mr. Trump is a big booster of fossil fuels, the coal, oil, and gas that have traditionally formed the base of the U.S. energy economy. Ms. Harris has taken a yes and position. Domestic oil production set new records under the Biden administration, and Ms. Harris has said she would not try to ban fracking, hydraulic fracturing, a way of mining natural gas that environmentalists say is ecologically damaging. But her focus is on developing what many experts see as the next generation of energy, wind, solar, and other renewables. Mr. Trump has said he would withdraw the United States from the world's main climate agreement, something he already did once during his first term as president, a move reversed by President Joe Biden. During the Trump presidency, Ms. Harris said abandoning the global agreement would be catastrophic for our planet, for ourselves, and for future generations. Mr. Trump has pledged to roll back a regulation that limits carbon emissions from coal and gas power plants. Ms. Harris was part of the administration that established those rules, and as California Attorney General, she prosecuted big polluters. The $437 billion Inflation Reduction Act is widely seen as the country's largest ever investment in climate change adaptation and resilience. The act was designed to fund the research and development of new clean energy sources, but also to supercharge private investment into existing clean energy technology. Boosters framed it as an economics and jobs act as much as an environmental one. The underlying goal was to help the U.S. become a leader in what the Biden administration characterized as the inevitable economy of the future, whether that includes electric vehicles or clean hydrogen. One of Ms. Harris's main priorities, if she's elected, will likely to be to continue to administer this money, 85% of which is supposed to go to clean energy initiatives, climate resilience efforts, and other measures related to climate change. after young climate protesters demonstrated outside her Los Angeles home this September, Ms. Harris promised that she would confront the climate crisis with bold action, building a clean energy economy, advancing environmental justice, and increasing resilience to climate disasters. Mr. Trump, for his part, has characterized the Inflation Reduction Act as an unfair payment to clean energy companies at the expense of the fossil fuel industry. Mr. Trump says he would pull back billions of unspent dollars and may end tax incentives for some electric vehicles. Some experts note, however, that most of the Act's investments and jobs are in Republican congressional districts. One of the biggest differences between a Trump and a Harris presidency might be in the relationship with the government agencies that work in energy or the environment. During the Trump administration, for instance, scores of professional scientists left the Environmental Protection Agency, with many researchers claiming that they faced retaliation and harassment for reporting their findings on climate change. As president, Mr. Trump both reversed a slew of environmental regulations and successfully lobbied to cut the EPA's budget. Much of the country's clean air and water enforcement, climate resilience efforts, weather forecasting, national park maintenance, and other everyday environmental tasks are implemented by federal agencies. How community kitchens are piecing Sudan back together. A network of community aid groups is providing pivotal support for communities affected by Sudan's civil war. By doing so, they're also showing that the ties that bind Sudanese together are stronger than the violence tearing their country apart. By Violet Ikong, contributor, Abuja, Nigeria. This is one of three articles from Sudan that we are publishing this week, highlighting that country travails and citizens' efforts to overcome them. As volunteers chopped onion and cubed lamb on a recent morning at the Abu Shouk displacement camp in Darfur, their goal was simple, to feed the hungry. The fragrant rice dish they were preparing that day, known as lamb kabsa, was enough for 3,000 of the camp's residents. In El Fashar, a city suffering from the world's first confirmed famine since 2017, that meal had life and death stakes. But for the volunteers, it also carried profound symbolism. Sharing food with people is deeply rooted in Sudanese culture, explained Salah Adam, a volunteer with Abu Shouk's Emergency Response Room, the local aid group that organizes the daily soup kitchen here. Before the war, we used to eat our meals outside our homes and invite passerbys to eat with us. Now, in this improvised city of tents and mud brick houses, sharing a meal became a small tether to that old life. Since war broke out between two factions of Sudan's military in 2023, the conflict, which has been unsparingly devastating for civilians. Among other crises the war has generated, half of Sudan's population regularly does not have enough to eat. And 8.5 million people are facing what global experts call a hunger emergency. With international appeals for assistance severely underfunded and aid delivery repeatedly restricted by fighting, emergency response rooms have stepped in across the country to fill the gaps. The group's efforts earned them a nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize and a spot on at least one prestigious unofficial shortlist. Through their work, they are also forcefully asserting that the Sudanese people's solidarity is stronger than the violence that has engulfed their country. They are our people, our family, our friends, and our neighbors, says Walid Kojali, who, like others in this article, spoke to the monitor by phone from Sudan. He is a volunteer at a network of emergency response rooms in the East Nile area of the capital, Khartoum, that together serve more than 20,000 people daily at 150 soup kitchens. Someone has to lighten them up and give them hope in the midst of this war. We believe it is our duty. The civil war began in April 2023, the result of a violent power struggle between the country's two top generals. Emergency response rooms began springing up soon after. But the tradition of Sudanese communities rallying behind each other in times of crisis is much older. There's even a word for it, nafir, which means call to mobilize or collective work. Nafir is about social solidarity, explains Ismail Hagana, founder of Global Aid Hand, a nonprofit that provides aid to displaced Sudanese. In times of struggle, from natural disasters to wars to pandemics, Nafir asks Sudanese to help those in need, especially the most vulnerable. For many young Sudanese, Nafir was a central part of the future they imagined when they poured into the streets in 2018 and 2019 to protest the rule of Sudan's longtime dictator, Omar al-Bashir. Those protests eventually unseated Mr. al-Bashir, but then the military-run transitional council that replaced him refused to cede power. Last year, a power struggle within that council exploded into war between Sudan's armed forces and the paramilitary group known as the Rapid Support Forces. As the war spread, young pro-democracy activists and other community organizers began a new form of Nafir. Although there is no precise data on the number of active emergency response rooms, a year and a half into the war, they are known to be operating in at least half of Sudan's 18 states. Largely funded by donations solicited on social media from Sudanese at home men in the diaspora, the emergency response rooms respond to a wide variety of community needs. These include repairing downed electrical lines, organizing evacuations, and filling the gas tanks of ambulances. But there is one constant. Every room operates at least two community kitchens. The setup of these kitchens varies, but they typically enlist local volunteers to purchase, prepare, and distribute one simple daily meal to those in need. You cannot imagine how excited children get whenever they see us from afar with food and donkey carts, says Mr. Adam, the emergency response volunteer in Abu Shouk. He has lived in the camp since the mass killings in Darfur forced him from his home in 2003. In the past year, this and other camps in the area have swelled as millions have been forced to flee fighting once again. It hardly matters, he says, that one serving of food must often be shared among as many as five people. They're just grateful that what could be their only meal for the day has arrived. Indeed, for many, this daily meal is a lifeline. Hunger is a constant for some 26 million Sudanese, half the population, and no less than 3.7 million Sudanese children under the age of five are experiencing life-threatening malnutrition. In early August, famine was declared in Zamzam, a displacement camp near Abu Shouk, and experts warn that nearly 800,000 Sudanese are currently facing catastrophic hunger, which is characterized by starvation, death, and destitution. This crisis is entirely human-made. Fighting has forced millions of Sudanese to abandon their farms. Food aid convoys have been attacked, and for 6 months this year, the Sudanese military sealed off a major border crossing from Chad, severely restricting aid delivery. In Abu Shouk, these conditions often force community kitchens to make hard choices. When there isn't enough food, volunteers prioritize feeding children first. Emergency response rooms have also been caught in the crossfire. Volunteers report they have been accused by both sides in the conflict of working for the other. We can't guarantee the safety of volunteers who go to the market or cook in the kitchen, says Mr. Kojali, the Khartoum volunteer. He says three volunteers were killed in their houses, and 15 others were recently detained and tortured for 2 weeks by the Rapid Support Forces under suspicion they were working with the Sudanese military. These accounts could not be independently verified by the monitor. But these challenges have not stopped emergency response room volunteers, many of whom see the work as a calling. We have limited resources, explains Ismail Ibrahim, a volunteer at the emergency room in Shagra, a village near Al-Fashir in Darfur. Still, he says, we want everyone to have something to eat, no matter how little. Caregivers needed for children, trees, land, and rivers. In our progress roundup, we're focused on the ways we care for young and old. In Australia, Indigenous nations win rights to ancestral land the size of the U.S., size of the U.S. state of Indiana. In New Mexico, child care is free to most families. And in Kenya, citizens are reforesting. By Erica Page, staff writer. Once labeled worst in the nation, New Mexico is now a model in early childhood education. For years, the state has ranked among the lowest performers when it comes to childhood well-being, so policymakers focused more resources on children up to age 5, when interventions have been shown to be key for long-term success in education and life. Elected on an education platform, Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham formed the Early Childhood Education and Care Department in 2019. 2 state investment funds support early childhood efforts. In 2021, New Mexico expanded child care subsidies to cover families making up to 4 times the poverty line. And to encourage more workers in the industry, the state boosted reimbursements to child care providers. Today, about 1/2 of New Mexico families are eligible for free child care. It's as close as any states have gotten to trying to get to a universal coverage, says Haley Hines of the Cradle to Career Policy Institute. From the High Country News. Jamaica halved government debt over the past decade. In 2012, Jamaica faced a ballooning debt crisis, with national debt at 144% of gross domestic product. By 2023, that figure had fallen to 72%, and it's predicted to continue dropping. Despite relatively low economic growth, the country turned things around with the help of a newly negotiated loan from the International Monetary Fund, IMF, in 2013, and a series of fiscal reforms. These included privatizing some government agencies and overhauling the pension system. Economists also point to a sense of fair burden sharing that built consensus across political parties and included a freeze on public sector wages. An innovative committee with representation from government, civil society, and the business world monitors and reports on Jamaica's economic progress. The unemployment rate has also fallen from nearly 10% in 2013 to just over 4%. Last month, the IMF named Jamaican Finance Minister Nigel Clark one of the organization's 3 deputy managing directors. Sources: Foreign Policy, Financial Times, Brookings Institution. A mobile app is helping everyday Kenyans reforest their country. Some 50,000 hectares, 193 square miles, of forest are lost every year in Kenya, according to Nairobi-based World Agroforestry. To combat the effects of climate change, Kenya plans to add 15 billion trees, expanding its tree cover from 12% to 30% by 2032. Scientists developed the Jaza Miti app to engage citizens in the effort and improve the chances that the trees being planted will survive. Worldwide, some tree planting initiatives have been criticized for ignoring the needs of local ecosystems. Jaza Miti, whose name means fill with trees in Swahili, helps users choose the best tree variety for their location. The government is distributing seeds to centers, and the app points people to nearby seedling nurseries. Over 240 million planted trees have been tracked in the app as of mid-September. Sources: Reset and Voice of America. Teenage pregnancies in Thailand have fallen by more than 1/2 since 2012. Thailand has lowered the rate of pregnancies among girls and women aged 15 to 19 from 53 cases per 1,000 individuals to 21 cases. The government has now set a more ambitious target of fewer than 15 births for 1,000 females in that age group. The Prevention and Solution of the Adolescent Pregnancy Problem Act of 2016 is framed as a set of rights for young people, including the right to make informed decisions and receive social services. Schools, workplaces, public health facilities, and social welfare organizations give teens access to information, reproductive health care, counseling, and job training opportunities. Policymakers are continuing to focus on reducing the cases of sexually transmitted diseases. Sources: The Nation, Thailand, and the United Nations Population Fund. Indigenous nations win rights over 36,000 square miles of land in New South Wales. The ancestral claim was first filed in Australia in 2012 and affects the Nyamba, Nyigyampaa, Wagna, Puan, and Wailiwan peoples. Federal court decision ensures the right to access and camp on the land, as well as to hunt, fish, gather resources, and protect sites of cultural and spiritual significance. The area in the western part of the state is about the size of Indiana. Community members say the win is for generations to come. Hopefully, this will encourage them to stay connected to their country, heritage, and culture. says Auntie Elaine Olson, a Nyingma elder and one of the original applicants. Source, or Australian Broadcasting Corporation. Thank you for joining us for the Christian Science Monitor Daily, read by Shari McCundum.
The content featured in this recording may not reflect the views of Aftersight or the presenter. For questions, concerns, or editorial feedback regarding the Christian Science Monitor, please contact them directly at customerservice@csmonitor.com or call 617-450-2300 Monday through Friday.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.